As we step into lesson three, Lewis the Ethicist, we're coming now in the third talk in our series. And it's been a series where we're looking at Lewis and we're looking at the most popular Christian author in the 20th century. And we're looking at him because not only is he fascinating and everything you read of his just kind of grabs you, even things I disagree with Lewis on, I want to read it and quote it because it's said so well, right? Also because he's so helpful. He is so helpful. And even though in some conversations, and we'll get into this more when we get into apologetics, in some conversations, the conversation has moved on to some degree, it doesn't mean Lewis had a way of framing things that set the foundation, right? And so oftentimes we can look back and we don't know how we got where we're at, but when you start reading Lewis, you start realizing how so many of the great apologists that are currently out there got where they're at. And you'll read things and think like, oh, Lewis set the stage for them on this. And Lewis was able to do that because he's working between reason and imagination. He was teaching both philosophy and English. And he was at this interesting critical juncture in the middle of the 20th century when it was the height of modernism, when scientism was kind of the conversation of the day, and Lewis was bringing back the role of the imagination, the role of the arts, the role of speaking with poetry, the idea of beauty, and all those things now that maybe we take for granted that as Christians we should not only state the truth, but we should say it in a way that's beautiful because that resonates with a beautiful God. So where we've been, well, the first week, session we talked about Lewis the man, and then we went to Lewis the theologian, and today we're going to be talking about Lewis the ethicist. Lewis the ethicist. And so now, as we move into Lewis the ethicist, we're getting a little more philosophical. And so I thought it'd be helpful to start off by just a very quick primer on philosophy. For some of you, if you've never had a class of philosophy, some of you, this will be a warm-up. But just a reminder, there's three major branches of philosophy. There's metaphysics, which is the study of what is real. Has anybody in here ever taken a class on metaphysics? I'm just curious. Okay, metaphysics is tough, all right? The first book I read, I remember I had a class on metaphysics once, and the first book I read was called Naming and Necessity by Saul Kripke. He was a Princeton philosopher. I maybe got 10% of that book. That's maybe a, you know, and I came to class with a bunch of other graduate students, and we were all looking at each other like, is it just me? Like, was that a completely foreign language? And then when the professor started, the professor said, hey, I just want to let you all know that I didn't expect you to really get any of this, and you just have to keep working at it. You know, I've been reading this book for years, and I'm at about 85%, but this is an important book. And so metaphysics is the question of what is real. And then the second major branch is epistemology. That deals with knowledge. How do I know what I know? So those are conversations about how do we establish what we can and can't know? And then the final branch is ethics, and that is the issue of value. What is good? How do I know what is good? What should I value? And so that's what we're dealing with today. Now, Lewis, in many ways, has been characterized as a natural law ethicist. What is natural law? Two quotes on natural law. One is from Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, and one's from the first century. Thomas Aquinas describes natural law as, he says this, "The natural law is nothing other than the light of understanding placed in us by God. Through it, we know what we must do and what we must avoid. God has given this light or law at the creation." So that's Aquinas. And remember, Aquinas is gathering up the wisdom of the ancients, okay? He's gathering up the wisdom of the ancients, and he's merging Aristotle and Christian theology, all right? When Aristotle came on the scene, it was extremely threatening. Aristotle was seen as a Muslim philosopher in the 13th century. All the major commentators were Averroes, Avicenna. These were Muslim philosophers. And so Aristotle was banned. No one could read Aristotle, which made everybody read Aristotle. And everyone's thinking, this is really good philosophy. What do we do? Everyone's freaked out. The Muslims have this amazing philosopher named Aristotle. Aristotle wasn't Muslim, but Aristotle was retained through the Islamic world. And so Aquinas sat down in order to show how Christianity and Aristotle were actually compatible, and that's called the Summa Theologica. And so so this idea of natural law actually is an ancient law. It comes from Aristotle. We can see it in Cicero. Cicero writes, "There is in fact a true law, namely right reason, which is in accordance with nature, applies to all men, and is unchangeable and eternal." And so this is pretty much something that we've had around for a long time. There's an idea that that basically through our practical reason, we can have certain assumptions about what the good is. Now, Lewis himself, he shies away from using the word natural law. I think he does that strategically, but I also think it's true because Lewis is not interested in simply recapitulating any particular version of natural law, be it through a major philosopher or through a theologian. So Lewis, his own definition of natural law, I'm speaking of the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are. That's how he describes what he's going after, okay? He says, I'm speaking of the doctrine of objective value. So instead of using the language of natural law, I'm speaking about objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others are really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are. What does this mean? It means that if you see a mother bear, and that mother bear is tending to its young, you should have a certain kind of response. You should have a certain perspective of that. That would be different than if you see a mother bear and the mother bear is devouring her young. Okay? And that this was what was called the practical reason, or natural law, or the law of nature. Okay? Or as Lewis says, there's actually a correct response. There's a way you should respond, a certain attitude that's really true, and some are really false, and it's in terms of the kind of things that you see happening around you. This Christian theology oftentimes gets this from Apostle Paul's words in Romans 2, 14, 15. When Gentiles who have not the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. So we know as Christians that there seems to be at least a teaching that people are not completely blind, morally blind. And so this is kind of where this conversation comes in terms of Lewis's ethics. That's kind of some big ideas I'm throwing out there. Let me give you a map of where we're going to go today. There's two basic movements in my talk today. The first is I'm going to talk about general ethics, okay? Lewis's general ethics, the things that he holds broadly about right and wrong. And that's going to be the majority of our time today. And in this time, we're going to look at Lewis's ethical thinking before he was converted to Christianity. Then we're going to take a look at two of his important essays, one called On Ethics and one's called The Poison of Subjectivism. And then we're going to finally look at his major work on ethics, which is called The Abolition of Man. How many of you read The Abolition of Man in here? Okay, good. If you're an educator, you really should read The Abolition of Man, because he actually talks about the way in which ethics and education interact with one another in there. So we're gonna do that the first half. So we're going to talk about his general ethics. And then because The Abolition of Man ends with this catastrophic destruction of the world, and I didn't want you to leave completely bummed. Like, I'm never coming back to this class again. After looking at his general ethics, we're going to look at his Christian ethics, and then we're going to take a look primarily at his three theological virtues, faith, hope, and love, which are the three, not just Lewis's, but the way in which Lewis characterizes those theological virtues, which is encouraging. So I am an American. I like to end on a happy note. I know if this was in France, we'd all die alone in the rain, you know, but I admit to my own cultural bias. So, all right. All right. Like I said, Lewis was not interested in trying to defend natural law as it was presented through maybe Aquinas. He says, "You will not suspect me of trying to introduce in all of its stoical or medieval rigor the doctrine of natural law. Less am I claiming the source of this ethical agreement anything like intuition or innate ideas, nor am I putting forth some argument for theism." So there's three things he's saying that he's trying to do in his general ethics. Okay, he's not trying to recapitulate Aquinas' natural law. He's not doing what a lot of modern ethicists do, okay? They appeal to some kind of intuition or there's innate ideas. He's not doing that. And he's also, at times, like with the abolition of man and in his essay on ethics and in his essay on subjectivism, he's not even arguing for theism. This is not an argument for theism. He does use his ethics in order to argue for theism, and we'll take a look at that when we get to his apologetics, okay? But what he's doing instead is something very different. And we can see what he's doing actually before he was converted to Christianity. So let's take a look at Lewis's ethics before becoming a Christian. In July 1922, when he was, I guess, 24, he mentions writing a dissertation on the hegemony of moral value. Hegemony means predominance. And it's interesting, at this point, he's not a Christian, so he's not associating morals with God. Yet he still believes in what philosophers call the absolute and saw morals as a great value. In October of 1924, while employed at the University College, he began a series of lectures on the good, its position among the values. And in March of 1924, he also read a paper on the hegemony of moral values to the Philosophical Society. And he has this spiritual vision of moral axioms. But again, he doesn't connect this in any way to the spirituality of man. From 1929 to 1931, we saw that Lewis converted first to theism and then to Christianity. And it's during this time that he holds on to this kind of axiomatic understanding of morals, but then his Christianity starts informing that. It's not until 1941 when he was asked to give his first talk on what would become the first book in Mere Christianity. And the first chapter is called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. So it was that talk, when he starts giving that talk, and at the same time, in 1942, the University of Durham asked Lewis to deliver the Riddell Memorial Lectures. These are lectures that go on at the University of Durham. The University of Durham is a really important university in the history of Christian theology, next to Cambridge and Oxford. There's been more bishops of Canterbury from Durham than anywhere else. So he was asked to give that talk on Mere Christianity. It was going to be on the radio. He was asked to give these lectures, and he decides he's going to go ahead and head into the issue of ethics. And so these gave Lewis reason to develop in a more deeper sense his view of ethics, and it resulted in two principal essays. One is called On Ethics, and the other is The Poison of Subjectivism. And then finally, it resulted in The Abolition of Man. Let's take a look at these two essays. Let's see here. On Ethics. So I put up here Christian Reflections. Okay, that's where you can find these two, On Ethics and Subjectivism. You can also find it in this, The Seeing Eye. I was grateful I had this because I went to go get On Ethics and The Poison of Subjectivism, and I'm like, how do I not have these essays? I consider myself a C.S. Lewis buff. This is crazy, and I'm glad that I found it in here as well. But you can find it in this new edition of Christian Reflections. People were asking Lewis where he stood on the debate on the necessity of returning to Christian ethics. Sound familiar? This is the middle of the 20th century in the UK. And Lewis states in his essay on ethics that although he's a thoroughgoing Christian, he calls himself a rigorous supernaturalist, an anti-modernist. He said he rejects the assumption of the debate that says, because you had one hand, you had people who said, we have to return to Christian ethics or our country's gonna be lost, it's gonna be hell in a handbasket. And he had those that said, we need to move beyond. It took us so long to be unshackled by traditional morality and all this stuff. Why would we ever go back to that? And so they want Lewis to step into this debate. And Lewis says, I completely reject the assumptions behind this debate. And there's two reasons why he offers that in his essay on ethics. He says, number one, Christian ethics is one among several bodies of ethical injunctions. But he says, these are not radically distinct from each other. Because these different ethical bodies are not radically distinct from each other, we can't say that the future of the human race depends on choosing the right ethical view. And then he also claims that those who are making this choice as if we are all sitting in an ethical vacuum are themselves denying the reality of the situation. Okay, there is no such thing as an ethical vacuum that you can sit in. Okay, so this is going to be important for Lewis. Lewis's ethics are really interesting. Lewis argues the idea that Christianity has brought a new ethical code into the world. Lewis argues that the idea that that Christianity brought a new ethical code in the world was itself flawed. He says, there was undoubtedly a deepening, a change of emphasis, but not a totally original moral code. He writes, only serious ignorance of Jewish and pagan culture would lead anyone to believe Christianity's ethics is a radically new thing. And then he goes on and says, Jesus uttered no command that had not been anticipated by the rabbis, few indeed that cannot be paralleled in classic ancient Egyptian, Ninevite, Babylonia, or ancient Chinese texts. Well, how many of you are going, oh, hey, we're doing a series on the Sermon on the Mount, right? I thought this was radical stuff. Well, Jesus is definitely clarifying. He's definitely, you know, calling us to a deeper understanding. He's going to say, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery. I say, don't even be lustful in your mind. So Jesus is getting to the heart of these ethical views, the law, but he's not erasing it. He's showing a depth and bringing a clarity. So now, I understand that there are certain Christian traditions that say the Old Testament is done. We just trash that, God's done, and now we have the Sermon on the Mount, and that's our only ethical principle. Lewis was not a part of that tradition. We're not a part of that tradition. Jesus wasn't giving us a radical new ethic, according to Lewis. And then Lewis says, if we were to stand outside all ethical systems, we are not in a place to have any ethical motives for adopting any system. Lewis has a name for people that stand outside of all ethical systems. They're called sociopaths, okay? If you meet one, you need to run, okay? Because Lewis says, the ethical is never really banished. People always inevitably have moral codes. Lewis says, when a man is wholly unethical, he does not choose between an ethical code because he cannot choose because he is subhuman. He's someone that needs to be placed in an asylum. I like this quote, and this is going to be important. And we're going to we might restate some of these ideas because it takes a while to kind of get into Lewis's mindset. But Lewis says, the human mind has no more power of inventing a new value than of planting a new sun in the sky or a new primary color in the spectrum. Every attempt to do so consists in arbitrarily selecting some one maxim of traditional morality, isolating it from the rest, and erecting it into a unum necessarium, which means the one thing that's needed. Do you see what Lewis is saying here? Lewis is saying, if you take nationalism, what is nationalism? Nationalism builds on a certain moral principle. It's the love of your country. Is it good to have a healthy love for your country? I think it is. Oftentimes I get in fights with, some of my theologian friends who are, super concerned anytime people get patriotic. I'm like, loving your country is normal. It's natural. It's normal to love your country. It's normal to love your culture. It's normal to love your language. It might be what Lewis would call storge. It's the love of the affections. It's the love of the familiar. It's, I have a favorite pair of jeans. All the jeans I have that I've worn, I have more of affection for them than your jeans because I haven't worn your jeans. I'm more familiar with these jeans, right? That's storge. That's a familiarity. And there's something that happens with familiarity. You just that's the nature of it's a kind of love. Now, when you set up that one kind of love, that one principle, and you elevate it above all others, so that loving your nation comes before all other moral principles, so that you can commit the kind of atrocities that were committed in World War II, now we've got a serious problem on hand. And Lewis is making the claim that when you look at nationalism, when you look at communism, when you look at secular humanists that might say that the only real good is the progress of the human race, that what they're doing is they're pulling out something that might be a good and they're elevating above all other goods, and then they're forcing everything through that rubric. And Lewis says that this itself is a reduction and dangerous. Now, in his essay, The Poison of Subjectivism, New Moralities, let me quickly quote this because it really reinforces. New Moralities are offering us the mutilated or expungated text of a book which we already possess in the original manuscript. Again, so there's this kind of expungiating, taking something and desiccating it. I'm so sorry, but I am going to try to do something here. because I can't see what's coming next. Well, let's see here. All right. Sorry, Phil, you're going to have to cut that from the video. All right. The Poison of Subjectivism. This is the next essay that he wrote, okay? Correct thinking does not produce good or bad behavior, Lewis would say. But in this essay, The Poison of Subjectivism, he goes to show that good thinking can provide a helpful check on unwanted behavior. And when that check is removed, evil can increase. And the check that he sees being removed is the check of the idea that there are actual truths, moral truths. There is a good and a bad. There is a right and a wrong. And so in this essay on The Poison of Subjectivism, Lewis addresses what would be called power philosophies, such as Nietzsche, who sees power itself as good and weakness as only evil. And so Lewis says that these kind of power philosophies that are emerging, whether it's National Socialism or communism or whatever, in the middle of the 20th century, really are drawn from a little insidious idea, which is called subjectivism, that there is ultimately, as soon as you start loosening up people's idea that there are rights and wrongs, that you don't just, you know, you don't just kill a baby, right? That seems like an assumption you would have, but you don't just kill a baby, you don't just kill somebody. You know, how do those get loosened up so we see the kind of atrocities in the middle of the 20th century? Lewis would say, ultimately, we can point to subjectivism as what drove so much of the atrocities we saw in World War II. Lewis writes in this essay, after studying his environment, man began studying himself. He had assumed his reason and seen all other things through it. Now his own reason has become the object. It is as if we took out our own eyes to study them. Thus studied, his own reason appears to him as the epiphenomenon, that's a nice word, which accompanies chemical or electrical events in a cortex, which is itself the byproduct of blind evolutionary process. His own logic, hitherto the king whom events in all possible worlds must obey, becomes merely subjective. Lewis is talking about what was taking place at the height of modernism, where we are now attempting to look at our own minds through science. And Lewis wants to say here that once we start looking at reason as an object which we can analyze, we forget that you can't do analysis without reason. There's no way to get outside of reason to analyze reason. There are certain fundamental laws of logic. One of them is the law of identity. A cannot be both A and non-A. Okay? If you break that law, you shall not open your mouth. Because if you tell me that is a banana, and banana can be both banana and Lamborghini, then I have no idea what you're saying. So unless we all assume certain fundamental laws of logic, really there is no such thing as meaning in the universe. Now Lewis is saying that man in his hubris, as a result of the Enlightenment, came to the place where he began to look at his own mind, reduce it to a brain, we could start with that, and see it as an epiphenomena, the mind as an epiphenomena, that there is actually nothing ultimately but an epiphenomena. What is that? That's something that emerges as a result of certain complex things happening. So the mind is actually, our thoughts are really only reducible to chemical processes and electrical things, the C fibers firing in the brain. And Lewis says, if you believe that your thoughts are merely the result, are ultimately just simply C fibers firing in your brain, then you can't have truth. And if you can't have truth, you could never communicate the idea that your brain, that your mind only gives you C fibers firing in the brain. Do you see the problem? It's cutting out from underneath the very assumptions which are necessary in order to have thought. And so this is where Lewis is attacking what he calls subjectivism. Lewis had a really great little essay, and it's actually in this one, The God in the Dock, on Bulverism. And if you bought that, you might want to read that. I wish that would have been the reading for today. I gave you something else, but that's a really good one too. And Bulverism is one of Lewis's most insightful statements about what's going to happen with postmodernity. Lewis was on the cusp of postmodernity. He recognized some things happening. Lewis writes this about the modern method of knowing. The modern method is to assume your interlocutor is wrong and then distract his attention by busily explaining how he became so silly. I found the device so common that I have had to invent a name for it. I call it Bulverism. Someday I'm going to write the biography of its imaginary inventor, Ezekiel Bulver, who at the age of 5 heard his mother say to his father, who had been maintaining that two sides of a triangle were together greater than the third, definition of a triangle, Oh, you say that because you are a man. E. Bulver assures us, there flashed across my mind, my opening mind, the great truth that refutation is not a necessary part of argument. This is postmodernity in a nutshell, right? I don't need to engage your argument. I just need to say, well, you say that because you're part of this socioeconomic group, because you're part of this race, you're part of this class, you're part of this gender. And that is not an argument. That's a personal attack. So I bring that up because Lewis is seeing how we're beginning to see what we call relativism, Lewis calls subjectivism, begin to undermine ethical values. You no longer have a real right and a real wrong. What you have instead is, just kind of a lack of confidence in our moral evaluations begins to seep in. Lewis says, the reality is, at most, we can flirt with subjectivism when it comes to theoretical reason. When it comes to theoretical reason, the process of rational analysis, we can't really take it serious because the very act of attacking theoretical reason requires reason. And so even though you'll see that sometimes, at the end of the day, especially, at the end of the day, you need theoretical reason. And so scientists need reason to speak about our theoretical reason as merely a blind product of evolutionary process, okay? It's ironic, right? That you'd have any confidence in the theoretical reason, which is merely the part, a response of the blind process. But Lewis says, we really only flirt with this. But when it comes to practical reason, and by practical reason, Lewis means moral reasoning. And the reason, and Lewis would say, the fact we no longer talk about moral reasoning as practical reasoning, we never even talk about moral judgments as practical reasoning, is because subjectivism has won. As we no longer associate reason with moral judgment. We've distanced them so far in our world of relativity that the idea that you would engage in rationality when it comes to decide what is the good demonstrates the power of subjectivism in our own day. Lewis says, when it comes to practical reason, our judgment of good and evil, subjectivism is operating in full force. It's only with modernity that we start thinking that our judgments of value are not rational, and that they don't discover truths about the world. Lewis writes, the modern view is very different. It does not believe that value judgments are really judgments at all. They are sentiments, complexes, attitudes produced in a community by the pressure of its environment and its traditions and differing from one community to another. Sound familiar? Yeah, this is the world we live in, right? Yeah. You hold that because you're part of this community, because and anytime you make a moral judgment, a moral statement, okay, even the word moral judgment sounds judgmental. This is how much it's in me, right? Anytime you make a statement about right or wrong, it's actually offensive today if you publicly make that statement and don't immediately couch it and frame it as, well, this is just how I see it. Okay, so Lewis is saying this shows that practical reason has been completely eviscerated. let's see here. Now, Lewis here wants to show that the idea that we can improve our morality for particular purposes, okay, is one of the things that is going to flow out of subjectivism. So when you look at all the kind of moral revolutionaries in the 20th century, okay, you look at Pol Pot. We're going to go into the countryside, we're going to kill anybody with an education, and we're going to start over. We're going to have some ethnic cleansing because these people had the wrong moral ideas. And we're going to then, this kind of radical, usually you can't just kind of wipe out masses. That's one of the, in traditional morality, you can't just kill a bunch of people, okay? But now in the modern period, we've evolved. Right? Since we no longer believe that there are certain inalienable moral rights and wrongs, we can just simply create these atrocities. And so this is part of improving our morality, okay? When you have people that believe in this, it really comes out of this idea of subjectivism. Out of this apparently innocent idea comes the disease that will certainly end our species and damn our souls if it is not crushed, Lewis writes. The idea that a community can choose its values as a man chooses clothes. And so you see this beginning to take place, where you have a lot of the thinkers in the late 20th century begin to rethink all of morality, and then begin to think they can shape morality, right? I mean, that was Hitler's whole thing. Now remember, Lewis is writing all this in the middle of the 20th century, where we see this taking place in Europe. This isn't theoretical. You see the complete rewriting of what's right and wrong in order to improve morality. The Germans began defining justice as that which is in the interest of the Third Reich. And having indignation, Lewis would say, to have indignation towards the Nazis makes no sense if you're a relativist. If you believe there are not truly right and wrong moral judgments, you dare not, and this came out in the Nuremberg trials, you dare not condemn Nazis because they're just simply doing what came out of their culture during their time. But Lewis would also say to progressive liberals, unless you have some overarching objective standard of good, a measuring rod, there is no way to assess what progress is. See, Lewis wants to say that nobody escapes some ultimate good, some value they operate from. And so more reformers who buy into subjectivism see the good as something that we've been conditioned to like. They consider whether there might be something better to like. Note that the term better, though, already assumes a standard. There's no way out. Throwing out traditional morals for the good of the community, okay, for the good of the community is really a version of do as you would be, Lewis writes, but the good of the community is really a version of do as you would be done unto. Sound familiar? So the traditional morality begins getting smuggled back in, inevitably. Or maybe the preservation of the human community is what we need to do. But then Lewis says, why? Why? Well, you're already assuming, again, a certain traditional morality. He says, if you say we have an instinct, Lewis was going to challenge that. And he'll do that in the second chapter of The Abolition Man. He's going to say, what do you mean by instinct? So anytime you try to, if you're a moral reformer and you want to throw out traditional morality, inevitably you're going to have to borrow from it. You have to smuggle something in, usually one thing, and you're going to hold that up, okay? There's a book that came out by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind. And the thing that's profound about it, Jonathan Haidt's not a Christian, he's a sociologist at New York University. He teaches in the School of Business Ethics. And Jonathan Haidt makes the claim in there that people that like to think of themselves as not being moral are incredibly moral. You can't escape being moral. If you go to the campus of UC Berkeley and you start holding opinions that are not progressive and liberal, you're going to receive a lot of moral indignation. Okay? Because you are now a victimizer. Now, where did they get the idea that we should support and help victims? Traditional morality. Okay? That's a traditional morality. That's a Christian view, by the way. The idea that victims should be protected and cared for, that the weak, hey, that comes straight out of a religion that claims that the God of the universe came down and was victimized, became a victim on a cross, and that we should actually see those that are weak and marginalized as a value. But the reason why there's this conflict is because if you go to UC Berkeley, they're not holding to other parts of traditional morality. They want to take that piece, which is protect the weak, but then it doesn't get evenly. And the same thing can be said for conservatives, right? If you want to, I mean, I'm not trying to pick a political side. I'm just claiming that new moralities tend to take one moral piece of traditional morality. And this is Lewis's argument. I think he's right. And they elevate that, and they read everything through that moral lens. All right, a little bit of warm-up. Some of you are already getting your questions ready for when we end. That's good. All right, let's get to Lewis's major work, The Abolition of Man. And we're going to look at the three major essays in The Abolition of Man. The first is the first essay, Men Without Chests. Remember, this was originally lectures given at Durham University. The Abolition of Man is a very prophetic work. There's a lot of things that that Lewis cautions about that actually ended up taking place. It was published in 1943, like I said, when Germany had reached its high point. The argument in a nutshell is this: if society rejects a transcultural, transcendent moral order, civilization and society will decay into a dystopian society of epic proportions. World War II, Nazi Germany, right? He does not argue that moral order comes from God. This is not a theological treatise. He simply argues that moral order is something we see all around us, and that we can't escape it. Any more than you can escape reason, theoretical reason, you can't escape practical reason, Lewis would say. It's the lens through which we end up viewing the world. We cannot cease being moral creatures. Well, we can, but you end up in an asylum, okay? Or you should end up in an asylum. The argument is a reductio ad absurdum. That means that you reject an argument by showing that it leads to something that is impractical, impossible, absurd, ridiculous, terrible, okay? All right. The first essay, Men Without Chess, he begins this essay talking about a textbook from a high school, high school students in England during that time. He doesn't want to name the actual textbook, okay, because Lewis is being charitable, and his whole point is not to just fry these people that wrote an English high school textbook. But we know who they are. The book is The Control of Language. The authors are Alex King and Martin Ketley. But Lewis doesn't want to do that, so he calls it The Green Book, and he gives the authors of fictional names, Gaius and Titius, which means a guy and a fellow in Latin, okay? Okay. And the book starts by talking about Coleridge. Coleridge is a great example of someone who believed that when you see something, you should have a certain sentiment about it, and that's part of your moral development. If you see someone being raped, you should feel repulsion and a need to help. If you see someone, these are just normal parts of your development as a human being. But Coleridge starts with Coleridge, who there's two tourists, is a famous story, where two tourists are seeing a waterfall, and one says the waterfall is sublime, and the other one says it's pretty, and Coleridge praises the first one, who says it's sublime, and he criticizes the second for their predication of the waterfall. Now, Gaius and Titius tell us that these tourists are actually not giving us value predicates about the waterfall, they're only expressing their feelings. So this is in this book, that they're not really making any statements about anything other than their feelings. Lewis writes this: until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. They believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence and our contempt. As Lewis then goes on to point out, not only Coleridge, but Shelley, Traherne — I hope you read Traherne someday, amazing — St. Augustine, Aristotle, Plato, within the Hindu idea of Rita, the Chinese idea of the Tao, the Jewish idea of the law, all basically traditional morality assumed that we were to be able to have certain sentiments as part of your training, your moral development as a person. And then Lewis writes, but what is common to them all is something we cannot neglect. It is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of things the universe is and the kind of things we are. So Lewis is saying this has become dislodged, this idea that we should have certain sentiments. Notice he's not saying thoughts, he's saying sentiments, okay? And that's gonna be important. Now Lewis here is going after, more specifically, and we brought it up, a certain philosophy that was rampant in the middle 20th century called logical positivism. And logical positivism is the idea that it was put before by A.J. Ayer in Language, Logic, and Truth. It's the idea that only those things which are empirically verifiable and analytically defensible are true. So if I say it's sunny outside, can I defend that statement? Well, you can go outside and see if it's sunny. Okay. If I say it's a beautiful day, there's no empirical verification. All right. Or if I say a square has four sides, well, that's analytically defensible. By definition, a square has four sides. Okay. But again, if I was to say it's sunny outside, well, you can't really do an analytical defense of that. So logical positivism reduced the world tremendously. Lewis here is responding to this. And Lewis here believes that when we take out statements that involve feeling, that involve sentiment, that involve attitude as giving us truths about the world, we produce men without chess. What's he doing? What's he doing here? He's drawing from Plato's anthropology. Plato talked about the three parts of man: Okay, you have the head, you have the chest, you have the lower body, the belly. And those correspond to three different faculties: our thinking, our sentiments, and then all of our drives. And Luce is saying that what we see taking place is we're ripping out the role of the development of the sentiments, correct sentiments. Now, when you're raising your children, hopefully you do that, right? I mean, if your kid brings, like, you know, something out of the bathroom that looks like it came from the toilet, you're gonna say, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, my sister was really good at this. She's like if my daughter one time put her hand up by the stove, and my sister yelled at her, and like, "What are you doing?" She's trying to create this feeling, this certain kind of feeling. You know, putting your hand by the stove, you should feel scared, you should feel danger, you should feel certain things. Correspond, your sentiments should correspond to reality. When you see certain things, your sentiments should correspond to reality. And if they don't, if you don't have certain kind of attitudes towards things, your humanity is deprived. But when we have a book that tells us that if you see an amazing, impressive waterfall, or if you're out, you know, hiking the John Muir Trail and you see this amazing, you know, these mountains, we have some mountains here, and you don't have this feeling of humility, of smallness, a recognition of your own finiteness, something is missing in your humanity. That's the appropriate response. If you look at these amazing mountains and you look and you think, worthless junk, we should bomb those. Why are we laughing? We're laughing because we know there's something odd about that. I met a guy one time who told me, "I'm really into the vulgar." I thought, something's morally deficient with you. Like, the vulgar should repulse. It should not draw you in. So Lewis here is saying that we now have a society that is creating men without chests. We no longer educate the chest. We no longer create certain kind of sentiments. Lewis writes, "On this view, the world of facts without a trace of value and the world of feelings without one trace of truth or falsehood, justice or injustice, confront one another, and no rapprochement is possible." So you have fact and value dichotomy. And this is the language we live in. This is our public language now. We're constantly saying, well, that's a fact, that's a value. If you say something about what you think is right or wrong, people immediately usher that into, well, those are your values. That's how you feel, right? This is how I feel. And so we've already said that there are things we can't do, which is we can't make moral judgments. We were told it long ago by Plato, as the king governs by his executive, so reason and man must rule the mere appetites by means of the spirited element. The head rules the belly through the chest, the seat of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. The chest, between cerebral man and visceral man, it may even be said that it is by this middle element that man is man, for by his intellect he is mere spirit, and by his appetite mere animal. When I used to teach middle school in the ghetto, and a kid would steal some other kid's thing, here's what you couldn't do. You couldn't say, let's get in a big debate about why you shouldn't do that. What you had to do is you had to look him in the eye and said, you know you shouldn't do that. Because if you begin the debate where you're going to say, well, should we pull from Kant's categorical imperative or Jeremy Bentham's view of utilitarianism, all bets are off. You're going to lose that debate, right? Because they can out argue you. All you have is an appeal, and the appeal is you know better. And Lewis agrees with that. Lewis wants to claim that in the same way, if you meet someone that says, if I say an apple is an apple, it can be an apple or a banana, and you're like, well, let's, you know, okay, but I'm not talking to you. Because, you know, or if you're sitting in front of a board and you say 1 + 1 = 2, okay? And you have a child in the class and you show, if I have this apple and this apple, I have these apples, and you have a child go, not seeing it. What's your recourse? You have no recourse. A philosophical discussion at that point doesn't work. And this is Lewis's point, that there's certain things you just know by virtue of being born. God has put this light within you, and they are moral judgments. And you know it, it's on your conscience, it's part of the operating equipment. Now, Lewis is not giving a theological argument for this, but Lewis is making another claim, which is, If we remove that to the degree in which we remove those moral sentiments that should follow as part of us making moral judgments, what we do is we end up destroying our humanity. So that's part of the abolition of man. That's part of the way we abolish our humanity. Luce writes, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and beg the geldings be fruitful. So this is kind of the situation we find ourselves in. We find ourselves in a situation where we're constantly asking of people virtues that we're not instilling within our society. And sadly, lately, I think that we're not even asking for them anymore, which is a tragic situation we're in. All right, second section, the way. The way, or the Tao, which it means the same thing, okay? In that hideous strength, Mark Frost, this is one of Lewis's books in his science fiction trilogy, Mark Frost is given training in objectivity, which is designed to kill all natural human preferences. So he's in a room. The room is ill-proportioned. There's a portrait of a young woman, but she has hair in her mouth. Now, there's a picture of the Last Supper, but then there's these beetles that are under the table. There's a giant manis playing a fiddle while being eaten by another giant manis. There's a man with corkscrews for arms. And gradually, Mark finds himself in this objectivity training. And he finds himself despising it. And it says, there rose up against this background of the sour and the crooked some kind of vision of the sweet and strong. Having his first deeply moral experience, he was choosing something else, the normal. This is how Lewis depicts what happens when we attempt to push people against the Tao, when you try to erase the Tao. The Tao is this natural instinct we have, given by God, certain moral kinds of assessments. And so the second chapter is all about this. The second chapter is all about the impossibility of establishing a basis for values apart from simply the fact that they're given to us. There's something given. Lewis writes this. That was the quote. However subjective they may be about some traditional value, Gaius and Titius have shown by the very act of writing the Green Book that there must be some other values about which they are not subjective at all. The important point is not the precise nature of their end, but the fact that they have an end at all. They must have, or their book is written for no purpose, and this end must have real value in their eyes. So even people that assume that we can sit outside of morality and pick a morality are themselves never immune from having some greater good, even in the act of doing that. Another way of saying this is, we are ethical creatures to the core. We can't help but assign values. There is no world where there is not some good that is latent. Or in the words of St. Augustine, if you tell me what you love, I will tell you what you worship. And so all of the new moralities at the end of the day end up pulling from the Tao, which we've already kind of made this point. So Lewis writes, a great many of those who debunk traditional, or as they would say, sentimental values, have in the background values of their own, which they believe to be immune from the debunking process. Again, we're starting to kind of repeat the ideas. Is it soaking in now? You see it? I think, do you have, kind of have that down? Yeah? Yeah? All right. Yep, same thing. Lewis then goes after in this second chapter, those who want to pull from instinct. He says, telling us to obey instinct is like telling us to obey people. People say different things. So do instincts. Our instincts are at war. If it's held that the instinct for preserving the species should always be obeyed at the expense of others' instincts, whence do we derive this rule of precedence? Or maybe a better one to put in our own language is, people will say, follow your heart. See, that's our ethical maxim today. Follow your heart. Well, then the next question is, what if my heart is telling me lots of different things? Like my heart's telling me that you are irritating, I'm going to hit you. Should I follow that part of my heart? Oh, okay, it's not that easy. See, all of the different things that are being kind of put out there is the way in which we develop ethics, inevitably. Now, there is a place and a time where your own preference should be given certain moral weight. But holding that up as the ultimate maxim for all ethical thinking is absolutely ridiculous. All right, let's go to the final section, the abolition of man, because I do want to say something positive before we have Q&A. Lewis's final section in the abolition of man is called the abolition of man. And Lewis, in this is really crazy stuff. What we call biotechnology and all the question about what's going on, the ethical issues in biotechnology, Lewis just steps right into that. And we don't have time to completely unpack it here. But Lewis basically wants to talk about the way in which our choices now are different with the increase in our technology. So what he's going after is this kind of naive idea that as we grow with our technological proficiency, man increases his power. And so progress is always just better and better and better. And man's becoming more and more powerful. And Lewis says, it's a more complex story. In fact, he talks about, you know, you invent the airplane, fine. You invent the radio, fine. You invent contraceptives. Now, this invention here not only has impacts for your own generation, but all generations to come. In fact, he says, when we start talking about biotechnology, what we're talking about is not human beings growing more and more powerful. We're talking about power being placed in the hands of fewer and fewer people who are making decisions for the entire race. Which is true, right? Extremely scary. And in fact, eugenics was taking place when Lewis wrote this in Germany, where they're doing all kinds of experiments on people, right, on Jews, in order to create a super race, a master race, right? So Lewis is saying, we've left traditional morality, and now we've given it over, and now we have people that are trying to control and manipulate humanity with their own new moralities. And what we're going to do is ultimately destroy humanity. Because, and this is where he comes to, he says, if you take it, if it finally going to come down to somebody who's in charge of making a decision, it's going to be a small number of people making a decision for the rest of humanity based on whatever biotechnology. He says, and if there is no overarching rule that everybody must submit to, what will be the basis for them making that decision? And Lewis says, the basis will be the weather, their digestion, maybe their particular moods and states. And while we thought that we had conquered nature in the end, nature will have conquered us. It's a humbling push against the kind of hubris that comes out of the Enlightenment, where we think through science, human beings can escape their own humanity. And Lewis says, we won't escape our own humanity, we will destroy our humanity when we reject the God-given moral maps that we are born with, our conscience. I'm going to fast forward here to see here. Those who stand outside all judgments of value cannot have any ground for preferring one of their own impulses to another except the emotional strength of that impulse. Our hope rests on the chance that benevolent impulses may be predominant in our conditioners. Those are those who are going to make ultimate choices with the technology. Because technology comes to a place where it starts influencing those that come after us in incredible ways, especially with biotechnology. And chance here means nature. Our future is thus reduced to heredity, digestion, and weather. And then he ends with this. Stepping outside the Tao, they have stepped into the void. Nor are their subjects necessarily unhappy men. They are not men at all. They are artifacts. Man's final conquest has proved to be the abolition of man. And it reminds me of the movie The Matrix, right? Where you kind of see these people that are being held captive through technology. And this has been done again and again in different kind of dystopian films. So, well, isn't that happy? Does everybody feel happy? All right. So that was Lewis in the Tao. Let me just throw us real quick into a few things. We talked about pride last week as a great vice, but let's look at some of the theological virtues that Lewis developed. So now we're talking about Lewis's theological ethics, and I just want to give you a few quotes because I'm an American and we need to end on a happy note. Lewis in Mere Christianity develops three theological virtues, and these are virtues that Christians are called to, and the first is faith. If we wish to be rational, not now and then, but constantly, we must pray for the gift of faith. For the power to go on believing not in the teeth of reason, but in the teeth of lust and terror and jealousy and boredom and indifference to that which reason, authority or experience or all three have once delivered to us for truth. So Lewis here is showing that faith is not the opposite of reason, that actually faith enables us to believe what we know is reasonable. It's not enough to believe. I mean, apologetics is good, and we're going to get into that. But having reasons for your faith is important. But those reasons are not faith, right? At the end of the day, what makes you hold on to Christianity is, number one, it's excited your imagination, I think Lewis would say. But number two, your faith. Your faith which enables you to hold on to that which you know, even though there are pressures which you know you shouldn't give into. Love this little quote on faith. Let's look at hope. If you read history, you'll find that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this world. Aim at heaven and you'll get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you'll get neither. Love that quote. And this is a great corrective for us, because if you've been following the trajectory of Christian theology, there's been such an aim to reclaim that there's not too much discontinuity between heaven and earth, that the new heaven, the new earth is really this earth refined, which I believe. But what can end up happening is that we don't show the discontinuity and we don't live with this kind of eschatological vision, which then will give us this incredible amount of stamina and perseverance in the face of life's difficulties. And then finally, love. This is great. To love it all is to be vulnerable. This is from the Four Loves. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable. I would add, to be a part of a church is to be vulnerable. And if you're not a part of a church, that's a very safe way to live life. And you're definitely invited to Christ Church or another church. But at the end of the day, all commitment and investment in other people is going to be a path of pain, right? If you love anything, it's going to hurt. It's part of the game. But what's the alternative? What's the alternative of risking? And so Lewis here reminds us that we're called to love, and that means that's part of our discipleship, of taking up our cross, is loving and entering into relationship. And then and then I'll end with this. Lewis believes that our love for God elevates all our other loves. So he writes this: I think God wants us to love him more, not to love creatures less. We love everything in one way too much, but in another way, we love everything too little. Lewis believes that when we love God first and foremost, all of our other loves are elevated. So take romantic love. What is romantic? What is eros? This is in the Four Loves. Eros is that kind of crazy state when you fall in love where you just can't have enough. You got to be together. And then when you're together, you want more. You just want more and more and more. And it's not like you get satiated. You just want more, more and more and more. That's falling in love. And Lewis says, that is just a picture of what heaven is going to be like, where we won't be satiated with God. We want more and more. And the pleasure of being in God's presence will only excite more pleasure, which we want more of God. And it'll be this infinite eternity of being in love with God. But then Lewis is also saying it elevates storge, that you can really embrace a nice pair of jeans, like, thank you, Lord, for these jeans, or thank you, Lord, for Sarah Madre, or thank you, Lord, you know, for whatever that kind of affection is. Or friendships, our love for God then elevates our friendships so that they become virtuous friendships where we're spurring each other on. Lewis would say all of our loves are elevated when we love God above and beyond all of this. So God calls us to a life of love, not just love of him, but love of all the good things, love of phileo, friendship, love of storge, love of eros. All these things are elevated in God. And so this is a window into Lewis's Christian ethics. So with that, I am going to close it off, and we'll have a time of Q&A. Wait until the roving mic comes. Go ahead, stand up, and be sure to state your question clearly.
Yes, my question is a little bit personal, sir. When you see a person, I consider myself an evangelical, and I'm always trying to engage with a person on my experience with God. So what would you do if you meet a person that has a mohawk with different colors, a ring on her eyelid or his eyelid, and her tongue, tattoos everywhere? How, right away, you want to react as a normal way, like you said, repulsed by it sometimes. But here's a human being with, see the life with color glasses. So how would you go about, or how we should go about?
Well, I think your question is a complex one, because there are certain aspects of style, right? Style, and also there's internal logics within subcultures. And so while you have to be careful, because while you might see something as being repulsive, within the internal logic of a subculture, there might be all kinds of meaning in what is being displayed. And so the first step is to understand that it might be letting you know your own subculture, right? And so God says he tattoos us on the palms of his hands. So tattooing is nothing, you know, that's in the Bible. So if you see someone with a tattoo, they're being biblical. That's the first step. The second thing you think you dress up, you look great. We think you look dorky. I mean, you know, so there needs to be some charity here. But if you see somebody and clearly there seems to be some kind of self-defacement and pain, man, that is an opportunity to love somebody, right? If somebody's doing something that seems to be, destructive or hurtful or self-destructive, man, what an opportunity to enter into just, and what I try, when I meet somebody that has funky hair and it's really bright, I say, man, that is cool hair. I wish I had hair, you know? But I point it out, because clearly if you have pink hair, you want people to know you got cool pink hair. So let's just acknowledge the what's in the room. Thank you for the question. Yeah.
Doctor. Help me, this vocabulary of faith is a virtue. One of the verses that challenges me, or the commands, or the truths, is that it's impossible to please God without faith. How do you connect that with all this vocabulary as love is a virtue? Can we straighten that out or even simplify it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that passage in Hebrews 11, faith is being able to believe in things that you don't see. And since God is not visible, it's going to be really hard to have an intimate relationship with someone who is not visible and please that being if you require visibility or empirical data. But I think that, you know, without faith, it's impossible to please anybody. It's impossible to please your spouse, right? If you're constantly not trusting them, I mean, if you've ever been in a relationship with someone that doesn't trust you, why'd you do that? Who were you on the phone with? I mean, after a while, you're like, look, this is not gonna work. You know, you have to give me some trust. Trust is the actual mechanism in which all relationships work. So without faith, it's impossible to please God, it's impossible to please other people. And we need to believe, and this is hard sometimes, we need to believe that God has our best interests in mind. And when you go through personal tragedy or difficulty, sometimes that's a very difficult thing. But God wants us to believe that he has our best interests in mind, and that pleases God. So those are just some thoughts, Scott. I don't know if that addresses where you're going with that.
Yeah,
but,
thanks.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not quite sure how to formulate the question, but it begins with, at the beginning you were talking about how C.S. Lewis said there was this tremendous continuity between traditional Christian morality and the moral values of the ancient world. And,
yeah.
And I guess you could also say that continuity would exist with traditional cultures around the world.
Yeah.
So you have that continuity there, but what was it in the 20th century where these other non-traditional ideas of extreme subjectivism, were there any antecedents of those values? And if so, why in the 20th century did they gain so much traction? So that today, we're sort of fighting a rear guard action against this new regime of values that rejects traditional Christian morality?
Yeah, that's a really good question, yeah. Yeah, and I failed to mention that the Tao, he actually went through the encyclopedia, before he gave his lecture, it was the this encyclopedia, I can't remember, it was 13-volume set encyclopedia on religion and ethics, where it goes through all the different ethical views of the world. And then he put this together in a compendium at the back of the Abolition Man, which he calls the Tao. And he has all these kind of the law of special benevolence, duties to parents and elders, duties to children and posterity. So he went through this. So all ancient traditions, they had these certain fundamental things they shared, certain kind of basic moral assumptions that were shared. And so the question is, what happened that dislodged that? And I think the answer is that we no longer believed in revelation. We no longer believed that there was a certain givenness to our knowledge. Okay? Once you start chipping away, and this is part of the Enlightenment, once you start chipping away at the idea that there's a certain givenness to your knowledge, okay, within epistemology it's called the principle of credulity, is that if I look and I see that, I don't know, that wall looks like it's pink or peach or whatever, and if it's appearing that, all things being equal, I should assume that's what it is. Now, if you know, someone tells me, hey, you're colorblind, I go to the doctor, you're colorblind, then I can doubt that. But all things being equal, I should assume that is the case. So there was a certain kind of faith in the way in which we found ourselves to be in the world. There was a givenness. But once you no longer believe that we are at home in a world, and this is really about the history of secularization, but we are in an empty space, you no longer can take your fundamental assumptions and believe those kind of moral impulses, where you look at a mother bear, you know, eating its young, and you know, things like that. So suddenly this whole repository, way in which we approach knowing things, gets questioned. And then there's this kind of mad dash to somehow give a rational. I mean, there's really this kind of like fear of we need to somehow shore up our humanity with reason. That's very much the Enlightenment project. So all of the different ethical systems that start emerging from the Enlightenment are an attempt to shore up what really is a gift. It's a given. It's the conscience. It's what Christianity calls the conscience, and you know, or Taoism calls the Tao, or all these other religions assume is just a givenness that we have. And so it really comes out of a view of the world as being, of the self as being buffered from the world. So there's a buffer between me and the world. I can't trust that there's a givenness within me. And it's a fundamental shift within the way in which we view things. So it's a huge topic, but yeah, how did we get to this place, right? Yeah. All right, any other questions? All right, good. Well, thank you, and I appreciate the time. And next week, we'll begin looking at Lewis the Apologist. Thank you so much.